It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. We'll find out what impact the Great War had on the world of literature.
First, oral arguments in the John Doe investigation appeal began at 2:30 this afternoon before the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago.
The investigation was looking into whether or not Governor Scott Walker's campaign illegally coordinated with third-party groups in Wisconsin, like Club for Growth. That was halted by U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa back in May as he decided there wasn't sufficient evidence to warrant continuing the investigation.
Prosecutors are appealing that decision. At stake today is whether or not the investigation into the Walker campaign's activities will continue. The decision could have some sway over the November 4th gubernatorial elections, but it remains to be seen if the Seventh Circuit Court will make a decision before that time.
Here with us now to talk about the arguments being made in court today, we have Howard Schwaber. He's a legal expert and professor of political science at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Well, the event that led up to this was a U.S. District Judge Randa stopping this John Doe investigation. What was the reasoning there that brought us up to today?
Well, you have to back up a little bit to answer that question and ask what was at stake in the investigation in the first place. So there's a Wisconsin state law that says it's not lawful for a candidate and outside groups to do what's called coordinating. And the idea is it's perfectly okay for a group that favors a particular policy to take out an ad that says, you know, vote for low taxes. It's perfectly okay for a group that favors, let's say, Scott Walker for governor to take out an ad that says, vote for Scott Walker for governor. What would not be okay is for Scott Walker to coordinate with that group because that would go around all of the limitations on campaign financing. At that point, there would be unlimited financing because none of the traditional channels for campaign financing and campaign expenditures would be visible. That's particularly true because these groups can list themselves as social rather than political, and therefore can remain anonymous. And the disclosure laws don't apply to them, even though they're undertaking political advertising. So here we had a situation in which there was a guy in Scott Walker's office named R.J. Johnson, who was a key advisor, and he told Walker, you should tell all of the people interested in donating to your campaign to instead give money to Wisconsin Club for Growth. R.J. Johnson is also the chief advisor to Wisconsin Club for Growth. So he would then take off his Scott Walker hat and put on his Club for Growth hat and decide how that money would be spent on ads that would favor the governor. And this allegedly was not coordinating. In other words, the court found that R.J. Johnson was not coordinating with himself, which is kind of remarkable in a way. The reason is there's a two-part argument that Judge Randa relied on. First of all, because these were ads that did not say re-elect Scott Walker or don't recall Scott Walker, but only said don't recall a governor who cuts taxes or don't recall a governor who stands up to teachers' unions, they were not political expression.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they didn't fit what's called express advocacy. They were only issue advocacy. And Randa concluded that where the Wisconsin law talks about political activity, it only includes express activity, advocacy that names a candidate. That's a bizarre statement in a way. The idea that it's somehow non-political to say, you know, elect a governor who favors low taxes, whatever you think of low taxes, is a strange interpretation of the law. Randa didn't invent that interpretation, though. It's actually, I mean, as artificial as it sounds, it's one that the courts have discovered before. But he then added a second argument, which is even where there is coordination of political activity, he said, there's no risk of corruption as long as the group spending the money shares the basic views of the candidate. And this is where we get into a territory that's really kind of crazy. Because the idea is, no matter what the level of coordination, right? The first argument was it all depends on the nature of the message. The second argument is, no matter what the message or the extent of the coordination, there can't be any fear of corruption involved because, after all, they agreed in the first place. So those are the two arguments that are going to the Seventh Circuit. And the Seventh Circuit panel of two Republican appointees and one Democratic appointee will review those arguments and decide if they were a good reason to put a stop to the criminal investigation.
Right. That investigation is stopped now. In part today, prosecutors are hoping to reopen it. What case do they have to make to get the ball rolling again?
Well, it's not really clear. The factual case is pretty strong. That is, there was an inadvertent release of some email evidence back in August. And it's quite clear that Walker got this advice. It's quite clear. He told donors to give money to the Club for Growth. There are emails of one of his other advisors saying Governor Walker wants all money funneled through the Club for Growth. We're talking millions of dollars here. The Cook brothers are involved. Karl Rove is involved. It's quite clear Club for Growth coordinated the content and reviewed the content of advertising to make sure it was consistent with the message that Walker wanted. I think one of the best emails is from an advisor named Kate Doner. The governor wants all issue advocacy efforts run through one group to ensure correct messaging. So in other words, there's very little question on the facts that there was coordination going on. The case prosecutors have to make is a legal one. They have to persuade the Seventh Circuit that where there's that kind of coordination going on, the fact that the ads didn't mention Walker's name doesn't make them non-political. And they also have to convince the Seventh Circuit that where there's that level of coordination going on, the fact that the governor and the group supporting him share a general ideology doesn't mean that there's no possibility of quid pro quo corruption. Those aren't really factual questions. It really is much more a matter of the legal standard that's at stake.
And a lot of this is coming about because Club for Growth members brought lawsuits against the prosecutors saying, hey, this is violating our free speech rights. If we can't do our political activity, you're violating federal rights here.
Well, that's right. And interestingly, those lawsuits point out one of the fallacies in Randa's argument. Right. So Randa argues that the Club for Growth and Scott Walker agree on everything. Therefore, there's no favors they could buy from him, and therefore there's no risk of corruption. But the fact is that they don't actually have the same agenda. Club for Growth is using this case as a weapon to try and strike down all restrictions on outside advocacy spending. They're arguing they're a private group. It's private expression of political preference. It's protected by the First Amendment. And therefore, the entire system of laws limiting coordination should be struck down. Walker would just as soon not have that fight. The last thing Walker needs is to have that, you know, is to have himself associated with the attempt to completely end all control of campaign financing shortly before an election. So right off the bat, if you look at this case, you can see that one of the fallacies of Randa's arguments is that there's never a possibility that a candidate and a group who share a general ideology might nonetheless not have specifically the same goals. The other problem here is that the Walker case involves the Walker campaign controlling the message by the outside groups. But if you accept the argument that Club for Growth is making, the reverse is equally possible. That is, it's equally permissible for outside groups to say, we'll spend money on your behalf only if you give us prior approval of your message.
And another thing going on in the court today, this is, as you mentioned, some records have been released throughout this. This is a decreasingly secret investigation. And in the court today, the Wisconsin Newspaper Association wants all the records of this case to be unsealed. Club for Growth would like to keep some documents unsealed. What's the legal back and forth over the secrecy of these John Doe investigation documents?
Well, traditionally, John Doe investigation documents are confidential, and that's one of the reasons that they're John Doe investigations. The law is quite unclear on this score. The Wisconsin Journalists Association is arguing that these are essentially public records and therefore covered by the Sunshine and Public Records laws that were, you know, Freedom of Information Act kinds of laws, which are quite strong in Wisconsin. Walker would like to have everything sealed, frankly. And Club for Growth has kind of a mixed position. They want some of these things revealed. That's really uncharted territory. In the past, attempts to get records of this kind revealed have been rebuffed on the grounds that it's necessary for the prosecutors to preserve the confidentiality of the investigation. And the fear would be that releasing the documents would impair the ongoing the fairness and accuracy and effectiveness of that ongoing investigation. In this case, given the amount that's been dumped already, and the amount that's already been presented in the press already, there's a pretty good argument that it's too late to close that barn door, and a full picture should be released. But that's going to require some balancing of factors by the court, and legally it's a murky question.
Are the documents we've seen this case in general affecting the race for governor in Wisconsin?
That's hard to say. It looks like the answer is no. But that's partly because the race for governor in Wisconsin was always close, and Walker has always had a strong core of support. There's always been an almost as strong core of opposition until the election turns on a relatively small group in the middle at this stage. It's not clear, however, that there isn't room left and time left for damage to be done or for an effect to happen one way or another. It's very unlikely that the Seventh Circuit will issue a ruling before the election. So most likely what we'll get out of this is a flurry of news stories, some more attention on these emails, and some more discussion of the roles that the various people have played. But barring the unlikely event of a decision by the Seventh Circuit unfavorable to Walker that comes before the election, I don't think this is going to have much more effect than it's had already.
Well, and whatever the ruling is, it isn't saying anyone is guilty or innocent of any charges. It's a red light or a green light on the future of the investigation itself.
That's absolutely right. So no one should assume that the outcome of the Seventh Circuit's decision has anything to do with whether anyone has done anything wrong or not. On the other hand, if Randa is overruled by the Seventh Circuit and the investigation is ultimately allowed to go forward, there's also a state judge who has to rule, it certainly will indicate that the prosecution is based on a theory of legal wrongdoing that could be recognized. And it's worth pointing out, a number of Walker's staff have gone to jail already for this.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Howard Schwaber, legal expert and professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the John Doe investigation case heard today at the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. The Great War was unlike anything the world had ever seen, and it would go on to change the world in many significant and unexpected ways.
And that included the world of literature. According to our next guest, World War I was a turning point for writers across the globe. In the years of the war and the years after, writers channeled their energy into putting their war experiences into words, and that helped usher in a whole new era of literature unlike anything seen before.
Joining us now is Jen Shelton, Associate Professor of English at Texas Tech University. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
So before World War I, what was literature like?
Well, literature before World War I had already begun the process of becoming what we now know as modernism. So there was a lot of experimentation going on. There were many manifestos being written that were rejecting the old ways of doing things. A lot of these experiments were technical in nature. So you can think about a text like Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist, which really tried to remake the novel in a new way. And that was published it was written before the war and published right about the time that the war was beginning. So those kinds of movements were already going on before the war ever started in response to a lot of the technological and social changes that came along because of modernity.
Now, World War I is known for being an especially brutal war, millions of lives lost, trench warfare, lots of horrors that, you know, people hadn't seen before, hadn't experienced and lived through. How did writers attempt to capture that?
Well, the big thing they did, and this is a little strange in some ways for us to think about, but the main thing they did was they tried to represent accurately the experience of being in that war and being in the trenches. They tried to portray it as it was and as it felt to them. And this was a profoundly new way to approach writing about war, because before, every time someone wrote something about warfare, it had to be couched in, that there was glory there was honor there, that this was majestic and good and noble. And of course, the soldiers in the trenches, I mean, as you say, it was a horrible existence. You were being shelled night and day. Your clothes were full of lice, and rats were walking over, dead bodies sticking out of the sides of the trenches. It was a horrible, horrible existence in the Flanders area. You were walking in a sea of mud. You had to walk on duck boards in order to avoid drowning in the mud. And so the soldier writers looked around and said, this isn't noble, this isn't glorious, this isn't honorable, this is hellish. And for what, right? Because, I mean, the other thing that we all know about the First World War, even if we don't know much about it, is that, tens of thousands of lives would be lost and nothing would be gained by this. And so they rejected, when I talk to my students about this, I often use the example of Alfred Lord Tennyson. He writes a poem like The Charge of the Light Brigade, and it's a doomed mission that is all very noble and majestic, and the poem kind of, rockets along with its beautiful little rhythm. And the World War I poets utterly rejected that kind of poetic strategy.
Right, and there was poetry coming out of the trenches, wasn't there, that managed to get around some of the censorship of the brutality that might have applied to other forms of literature?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people, because it's poetry, right, it's not like a news report, and so you could send your poem to, poems were published in newspapers back then. It's a funny thing for us to think about, but yeah, they were published in newspapers. People sent poems home to their families, and they were published in local journals and so forth. Some poets, like Siegfried Sassoon, was already an established poet before the war began, and so he had a lot of literary connections. And he was able to have his poetry and also the poetry of other people that he met and whose poetry he admired. He was able to have that published in various kinds of newspapers, magazines, and journals. Sometimes these were published in pacifist journals, like the Cambridge Journal, really trying to say, this is how horrible this war is, and that's the reason we need to stop it. So it was a way to communicate. You know, it wasn't an esoteric thing that people did just to amuse themselves, but it was a real way to communicate with the people back home and say, you know, this is the horror of this war.
Is it fair to think about this writing as a precursor to war journalism?
It is a precursor to war journalism. And, you know, books like All Quiet on the Western Front, which, you know, is published in 1928, which is a really big year for war memoirs and journals, that writer was a journalist. And so in portraying what he had experienced in the trenches in the most graphic way he could, he's using a lot of journalistic strategies, you know, to make it feel to the reader like this isn't an emotional account. This isn't about what it felt like. This is just what it was, right? And so in that way, it really changed war writing. It changed war journalism. It certainly changed even the newspaper accounts at that time. You know, the initial response to the war was, "Hey, hurrah! We're going to war, and we're going to beat whoever the other side is in 3 days and be back home again by Christmas." But in part because of this this creative writing coming out of the front, you know, even the newspapers began to say, "Here's what's really happening over there." You know, toward the end of the war, and then of course there was even more censorship because this was not to the taste of the governments who needed constant renewal of their resources at the front.
And did this leave a legacy of reluctance to get involved in war after World War I because of this documentation of what it was really like there on the front?
Yeah, the big years for war writing were the late 20s and early 30s. And this is just when the things are being set in place that are going to make World War II happen, and all, you know, everyone is reading these things really voraciously. Mary Borden, who's an American writer, had written a book called The Forbidden Zone, which was about the experiences of being a nurse at a front line, kind of MASH-like hospital, and there was All Quiet on the Western Front, and there were tons of memoirs, Robert Graves's All Goodbye to All That, and Sassoon's memoir, and Edwin Blunden's memoir came out, and people were reading these things voraciously, and they were looking at this and saying, okay, we fought the last war, and what did we get from it? And, you know, we look at all this horror, look at all these losses, and what did we get? And it made the Europeans in particular very, very, very reluctant to go into another war. Of course, the exception to that would be Germany, which was really punished by the treaty that ended the First World War. And for them, it was a sort of a nothing to lose, I think, kind of feeling.
And Jen, in our last 30 seconds here, is there a line of poetry or an image from this kind of writing that stays with you and really makes you think about what it must have been like?
Well, you know, probably the most famous line is in Wilfred Owen's poem Dulce et Decorum Est. At the end of the poem, he says, you know, he wants children to not hear, that old lie that is sweet and right to die for your country. And, you know, it's a really profound statement, I think, from him.
Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jen Shelton, Associate Professor of English at Texas Tech University. She joined us to talk about how World War I has changed the world of literature. Our next guest was diagnosed and treated for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as a child. He was one of the first generation of kids that saw growing attention to ADHD and the more frequent use of Ritalin and other medications.
In his new book, he tells the story of ADHD through the eyes of a longtime patient. It's his own life story and the life story of the concept of ADHD. Timothy Denevi is with us now. He's the author of Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. Timothy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, we often hear about ADHD told through the eyes of a parent or a teacher or a healthcare provider, and you try to recapture how it felt to experience it. You describe some of your earliest tantrums that you can remember around age 5. What did it feel like to experience that?
It's a very good question. When I began to write it, I was in graduate school, and I was thinking back to these moments that were on the edge of memory, some of my first memories, that I didn't really understand. And so by writing about them and trying to tell them, I began to kind of inhabit again through narrative those moments that have always stuck out to me as feeling like I was trapped behind the emotion I was feeling, as if the emotion was so extreme, the world itself, in a sense, fell away, and all I was left with was the way I was acting. And suddenly, after it would pass, I would see everybody else and in their eyes, the reflection of the strange thing that had just happened and passed both across me and across everybody around me.
And you write that some early efforts to understand hyperactivity, it's been called different things over the years, but at least some researchers viewed it in effect as a kind of moral failing. Did you feel as though you were being judged after those moments, that there's something wrong with you, that you were bad, evil?
I did, you know, and I try to write about that. It's very hard to address mental illness in a way, especially in the late 20th century, that doesn't have a moral component, because we so often believed it was, in the beginning, either environmental or, you know, biological, in the sense that there's something wrong with your soul, there's something wrong with your brain to a certain degree, that what's really going on and what's really wrong is a problem at the deepest part of you. And when I was a child, I would see these reflections in other people. And as I got older and was very overactive, I would suddenly come to, in a sense, and realize how upset everybody was with me. And it was very hard not to initially take that reaction as a judgment, which in a sense it was. I mean, to a certain level, I was trying to increase my self-awareness growing up at many points. That was the goal. But I always felt there was this gap between self-awareness and then these moments I would find myself in, and where the world would surge back across me, and I would realize just how extremely I was disturbing all of the people in my midst. It's different in adulthood, but you know, trying to recapture that point of view, in writing it, I did have to relive it a little bit, which was very strange.
What did the behaviors look like to those people around you, to parents, friends of the family, teachers?
The volume of my voice was always probably two levels above everybody else's. Just movement. Some teachers, you know, did a very nice job as seeing academic and behavioral development as separate entities. Other teachers, and in an understandable way, were very disturbed by it. And to them, it would seem as if I wasn't paying attention to anything that was going on. I would just be moving around in my own orbit. And when I did finally shock back, oftentimes it was through conflict. And so I learned at a very young age how to fight well, because my behavior itself created so much conflict. And one of the first treatments that I had for ADHD when I was a kindergartner moving forward, the second treatment after we tried drugs and it didn't work, was to learn how to react to the way people are reacting to me. Because soon enough, what happens is you see from something like this an enormous amount of conflict in the child's life, and you don't want a child to be learning how to be a really good fighter. You want them to be progressing with all the rest of the children forward in their natural development.
It sounds like just something that would keep escalating. You have these incidents. People would look at you differently. You know that they're looking at you differently, and it's just a downward spiral in how you interact with your peers and your teachers in some cases.
I think that's exactly right. And there's two ways to address ADHD. One is through its primary symptoms of inattentiveness and overactivity and impulsivity. in some cases, environmental changes can help with those. In other cases, medication can help. But another way to address ADHD is through its secondary symptoms. And by that, I mean how people react to the way you're acting. And so when I was in first grade, I had a very good psychologist. I was very lucky to grow up in the San Jose, San Francisco Bay Area and have access to incredible medical facilities. The psychologist was a former Stanford student, and she worked on secondary responses. So when somebody got really upset at the way I was acting, how do I then not escalate what I had just done, which is very hard because if you're dealing with issues of impulsivity too, you're very quick to respond back when somebody responded to you. And, you know, you're exactly right about that spiraling, and then you're not paying attention to what's going on in the classroom. Then you're learning how to fight, and then you're not developing the way that everybody else is. And so, again, you become further and further outside of everyone's normal path.
Well, that, as you say, was dealing with the secondary side of things. You also mentioned your first experience with medications, and it went spectacularly badly. Can you tell us about that?
This was in 1985. But after 1980, the DSM-3, when the DSM-3 came out, what you saw is a decrease in medication, usually through the primary physician, the pediatrician. And in my case, we had a pediatrician and then a psychiatrist who was very set on treating ADHD as a bacterium or virus, as in it was the same in everybody. This treatment reacted the same way, or everybody would react to this treatment in the same way, and this is how you did it. And my mother went into him and said, you know, I don't think this is working. I think that he's having a really tough time on this. I think he responds to medication differently because I respond to medication differently because everybody responds in their own way to medication differently. And he didn't listen to her, and neither did the pediatrician. And eventually I had this almost psychotic reaction when they were giving me too much Ritalin, they think, when I was 6 years old. And I freaked out and grabbed a butter knife and was waving it around. It's something that I barely remember. All the other memories are much clearer than this one. It's one I've heard told back to me many times. And it was very difficult because then immediately you have the drug and you have your behavior. And growing up from that point on, it was something I always remembered. And I always struggled with the idea of if a drug can help you get better, then did you do anything to earn that improvement? Or conversely, if the drug can't help you get better, then is there something wrong with you so deep down at your core that even a drug can't reach it? Either way, I felt a lack of agency.
Is there a debate within the treatment community? How much are we curing a kid versus how much are we taking away important parts of a kid's personality?
You know, one of the main goals in finding effective evidence-based treatments over the last 100 years in the research I've done that I've seen has been to see what does the most good without also doing harm. And so some things cause a lot of improvement, but they would also cause an enormous amount of harm. Stimulants can be very effective in certain situations. There's been a lot of smart people thinking about this disorder for the last 100 years and really applying all of the tools that we have available to us in terms of science and medicine to try to figure out how to decrease this conflict. I think it's tough to say that medication will never work or that it's a terrible thing. But I also think that what gets lost often in our discussion about it is that we're dealing with an issue at the border between biology and personality. And when you address something at that border, when you address something that deep down, that's both the brain and environment, not everybody's going to be responding to these treatments in the same way. And so when it comes to something like Ritalin, one of the problems that we run into is, in a sense still, what I experience is that everybody gets this amount. Everybody's expected to react like this. And there's not that space for the individuality, which is very important in psychiatric situations.
It seems like ADHD has been polarizing in some ways. You could hear arguments everywhere from everyone with ADHD should be taking medications almost to we should never use these drugs. They're dangerous and they shouldn't be part of the toolkit. What is it about ADHD that leads people sometimes to these positions on the extremes?
That's a very good question. I would answer that in two ways. One is that it's a borderline category of functioning. There's an excellent doctor, Dr. Xavier F. Castellanos, who said basically people with ADHD can do just about anything. They just don't do it very well. So we're not talking about the forms of social and medical disadvantage that people really struggle with in our society now. We're talking about people that look like children, that look like they're functioning in a mildly okay manner. And that's why it gets lumped in with these kind of moral issues. So it's really hard to find out how many children actually do have it, to what extent is it prevalent, and what are the best things to do about it. As a result, because it's kind of that borderline category right between the neurotypicals and right between, you know, moving in toward mental illness, it's often a very hotly debated issue because it really gets into this idea of will and morality. And if your willpower is stronger, why don't you just stay still? You know, if your parents weren't so bad, maybe you would be able to stay still. And again, after 100 years of researching into this and a lot of bad moves and a lot of good moves, one thing we've kind of arrived at is the idea, to use a common metaphor that most psychiatrists would tell you, biology loads the gun, environment sets it off. You can't get ADHD because you're around a bunch of excited people all the time. But the environment you're in can create an enormous amount of harm and conflict when it interacts with the symptoms and issues that you already have to begin with.
We're talking with Timothy Denevi about life with ADHD and the history of the condition and the ways we've tried to treat it over the decades. His new book is called Hyper, and you can join us with your questions, maybe your experiences. Have you or someone close to you been diagnosed or treated for ADHD? Do you think we're too quick to use medications, or have you seen benefits? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post over on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Timothy Denevi. His new book is Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you dealt with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, as a patient, a parent, teacher, maybe a healthcare provider? Call and share your experiences and your questions at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Timothy, before we go to our callers, I wanted to ask you about adult life with ADHD. How does it affect you as a grown-up?
You know, it's very different than it once was. The symptoms themselves, the issues, have diminished over time, and a lot of that has to do with natural physical development, the brain changing as you get older. And a lot of it, too, has to do with the fact that in adulthood, you often have much more control over your environment than you do as a child. And so I've learned certain things like exercising, which I really didn't start to do a lot until my late 20s regularly, just helps burn off a feeling of restlessness, which is kind of what the overactivity has become for me now. I'm probably more active than other 35-year-olds if you put me in a room with them, but that's not that overactive. You know, we're a sedate group now that we've entered this age. And so I'm much more in control of my environment around me, which allows me to deal with these kind of lingering issues in a really effective manner and has been really helpful. And I did start the last few years taking a low dose of Adderall, which helps, in a sense, with what I would say being overwhelmed. It makes everything around you closer and more immediate. And so if you're very stressed out and it's like me, you're impulsive and can feel that everything that you're looking at demands equal attention at all times, what the amphetamine does is it actually makes that course of action clear. So suddenly you know that you'll do this first, then this second, then this third. I've never in my life been able to put together an IKEA bed set or anything like that, and I'm still not very good at it. But at least I don't freak out if I sit down to do it, and I have taken a low dose of amphetamine. And so I try to use it, the amphetamine, to target specific situations ahead of time that I know are going to be difficult and have been difficult for me in the past. And it works right now, but who knows what will happen in the future. I think the best thing I can do is really look at my environment closely and try to understand what situations I have trouble with and what agency I have now when it comes to finding the right path toward functioning and being nice to the people I love.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Samantha on the line in Ettrick. Samantha, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I just, I'm really enjoying what he has to say. I'm 37 years old and was recently diagnosed with the ADD, they say. And I wonder now why they didn't pick it up when I was younger, and also how much the amphetamines that I'm taking really do help me in mostly my job, but also in my personal life.
Samantha, thanks for your call. Timothy, was it kind of just a random chance that might lead one kid in the 80s and 90s to be diagnosed with ADHD, another one not, even if they had the same symptoms?
That's a good question, too. One aspect is it's a matter of privilege. You know, in a sense, I was growing up in an area that had fantastic hospitals, and I had parents who were involved in every single aspect of my life. And my mother was willing in the mid-80s to try to do whatever she could to diminish this incredible conflict that seemed to follow me everywhere. And she was trying it in many different ways, of course. Another reason would probably be it's hard to diagnose ADHD and ADD in women compared to men. And by that I mean it's often underdiagnosed in women. A lot of that has to do with the guidelines. A lot of that has to do with our idea of ADHD as overactivity. But if we think of it in an attentional sense, as in what you're noticing and what you're not, that Russell Barkley, a doctor who writes about it often, calls it an issue with boundaries, you know, understanding how much time you need to give yourself, seeing when you need to do something and not crossing it, then we begin to see that it does cross genders a lot more. And recently, while there's a lot of issues with overdiagnosis, there are still areas where you do see, and it doesn't get talked about, underdiagnosis, where people go all the way through. It's often a matter of privilege. People don't have the resources, or they don't have family members that are really trying hard to find out what's going on. And it's often a matter of gender, where if you're not overactive, they don't think that anything that you're doing is beyond a moral failure or a willpower failure. They think it's just your fault that you don't, you know, that you're unable to do this. While what we've become and learned to see is that often people, like the caller who just called in, really have wanted to make these improvements their whole life and to make things better and have really struggled to do it and are beginning now in the 30s and in their 30s and 40s to receive evidence-based treatments that can really help.
Samantha, thanks for the call and good luck as you deal with that. We'll go now to Tim on the line in Green Bay. Tim, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Tim?
I was diagnosed with ADD when I was very young. I'm 27 now, and I'm a composition student, and a lot of my friends are creative people. But in most of them, I would say the ones that have been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, they find that the medication stifles their creativity. I decided to go off it for a period of three or four months, my medication, to see what effect it would have on me. And I found just the opposite. I couldn't create. And I'm wondering if it's just an over medication, or if it, or if the prescription is too high in those other people, or if it's something different.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of specifics there, Timothy, but your thoughts as a writer, among other things, on ADD, ADHD, and creativity.
That's a really excellent question. I would respond first from personal experience and say that when it comes to writing, what you need often is a wide perspective. You need to go very close to something, then you need to be able to pull back and give context to it when you're creating narrative or argument. And I've found that in the last few years with amphetamine, it makes things too close. So it's very good for doing something, for me, like filling out a job grant or other types of, you know, grading papers, things like that. But it actually, when it comes to writing, I'll write a lot. You know, I'll sit down and I'll do a lot. But I often then later see a flaw in the writing. Because when it comes to making art, everybody's different. Often, in my case, when I'm having trouble making the art, it's usually the art telling me I'm not seeing it correctly. And I thought that if I took Adderall and went forward, I'd be like, this is a great new trick I can have. You know, this is a great thing that to make art, to write. I found it didn't work out that way for me specifically. But if your art is installation art or recording music, or if it's another aspect of creativity, then I can understand in some way how it would offer improvement, because your body feels stiller. You feel not as desirous to stand up and change to something else and to do something else. I've noticed that when I take Adderall in adulthood, it's very hard for me to switch to a new task, or it's much harder than it usually is. And I think that could be helpful too, as Tim said when he was calling in, when it came to the months that he was off. And he probably was, you know, I can experience this myself, more willing to switch to something else instead of sitting down to do what you're supposed to do. So, you know, again, with everybody it's different, and with every task it's different. And that's one of the things that gets lost too, is that it's a very complex thing we're talking about, this border between personality and biology.
Well, speaking of creativity, you've done something with your ADHD here. You've written it. You've constructed this narrative of your story. Do you think that's going to help you deal with it and help you talk to other people about it?
I think it's a good thing. You know, Joan Didion would say we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And I think there's a certain aspect of narrative that in its telling is an act of expression. And that act of expression can be very important toward dealing with the subject that's at hand. And I think it's important that in the conversation we have right now about ADHD, we have voices that aren't simply doctors who've never experienced it themselves personally or ideologically driven groups such as the Scientologists who are going to have opinions on ADHD for reasons that line up with their specific goals and aims. And really, what's lost are stories like Tim, who just called in, you know, who have been taking it now for maybe 10, 15, 20 years and are just beginning in adulthood to figure out when it's best and when it isn't. And we didn't have that perspective 20 years ago. You know, this is a new perspective that's come into our society, and I think it's going to be a very good thing moving forward because we're going to have so many people that had more experience with it personally. And just like awareness, I think that experience does help to give us a better perspective on an issue such as this.
And from your perspective, what do you hope that the parents dealing with that first diagnosis or the teachers with the kid with ADHD in their class or the doctor trying to figure out how to tackle this, what do you hope they learn from your experience?
I hope that they learn that when it comes to something like ADHD, it's a chronic disorder and the goal is to keep trying and to keep working to diminish that conflict in any way that you can that doesn't also create more harms. And so it's to not give up, and it's to not say, well, this didn't work. This works with everybody else. Something must be wrong with you. You know, or it's to not say, there's nothing I can do with this kid. You know, this kid is off the walls. I should give up. I've done my best. My mother always gets really angry when she hears other parents say, I did my best. There's nothing more I can do. Because when you're dealing with something that's chronic, you don't really have the option to give up in that sense. The child doesn't have the option to give up. And all of the healthcare professionals and educators and parents, I think now are going to realize that we're dealing with something chronic and that's not an option either. We need to keep trying all these different evidence-based therapies, which are very effective. I mean, one of the good lines about childhood mental illness in general is, what we know now is actually very good after spending all these years doing it. And if you can access the many evidence-based therapies we have, be it cognitive behavior therapy, be it in certain cases medication, then you can really see improvement in the lives of these children.
We'll leave it there, Timothy. Thanks for joining us. That was Timothy Denevi. His new book is Hyper, A Personal History of ADHD.